Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And on our show today, we're going to be talking with Dr. Barbara Reimer about innovations to improve public health.
I'm excited about that, Christy, because she is the dean of the UNC School of Public Health, one of the, if not the top-rated school of public health in the country.
A remarkable woman. Looking forward to that conversation. But first, Adam, we're going to talk about some research that matters.
You know, the first study we have today. You know, we've heard a lot. Every day in clinic, it seems like I've got patients with arthritis, and it brings up this conversation about glucosamine. And I don't know if we've talked about it on the show specifically in the past, but there is some pretty good research that you can get a little bit improvement if you use glucosamine for osteoarthritis of the knee. So I guess the question is, can you get some improvement in other types of osteoarthritis with glucosamine?
And in this case, the question is, can people who have chronic low back pain due to osteoarthritis or degenerative joint disease in their back, is using glucosamine helpful for this population of people?
And I guess before I read this, I would have said an unequivocal maybe.
I would have said maybe too.
Because I still don't fully believe the improvement in the knee is very mild. It's not large here. So this research that was in the Journal of the American Medical Association perhaps lets us know that maybe it doesn't work so well for people with osteoarthritis of the back.
It's true. So this was a study of 250 patients, adult patients over than 25 years of age, who had chronic low back pain for at least 6 months and who had this degenerative osteoarthritis in their lower back.
And they took a daily amount of 1,500 milligrams of glucosamine or pills that did not contain this for 6 months. And then they followed these folks for six additional months and a year later.
And the bottom line is a six-month treatment with this oral glucosamine compared with placebo did not reduce pain-related disability after the 6 months intervention, and then they followed again a year later and saw no difference. So at least according to this study, it looks like it's not effective and may be a waste of money.
Yeah, it wasn't like they had worse outcomes or more side effects. So glucosamine can have some side effects, but these were small numbers. And so it is possible, even if there was a benefit, it'd be a small one. So I think most of us doctors, or at least Christy and I, doesn't think we're going to recommend this to you, our listeners.
I won't recommend it, but if a patient tells me it's helping them, then I'll say go for it. Okay, let's talk about the next one, Adam. This is about which communities embrace environmental conservation and which don't.
Well, you know, we're going to have Dr. Barbara Reimer on our show in a few minutes. We're going to be talking about a lot of the work in public health. And so I think we wanted to look at some of the research that's happening around public health and how this really relates to our listeners' health. And this research actually comes out of Durham, but not Durham, North Carolina, but Durham, New Hampshire. I wasn't even aware there was a Durham, New Hampshire. I am now. Of researchers looking at 7,800 people in 19 rural counties of 9 states about their views on environmental conservation.
And they looked at they made sure that these rural counties and states represented real broad types of rural places characterized by resource and population decline. And most of these the people living in these rural areas had high unemployment rates at baseline, and they found that as a group, they are less likely to support conservation efforts and any environmental regulations that are restrictive in this way.
Yeah, it was really pretty interesting here because it seems to reinforce some, you know, views about conservation, which at some levels I have to believe eventually has got to become a nonpartisan issue. It can't be something that's Democratic or Republican, male or female, employed or unemployed. It has to be something that's
rural or urban.
But in this particular case, it appears that it is.
It does. And I mean, I think it's helpful for us to start to identify people's views and, you know, looking at the variety of factors to start to have the conversation. If we can understand where we're coming from and what the reasons are, then hopefully we can forward that conversation and protect our earth while also forging ahead with new technology.
Yeah, right now it says that those who are Republican, those who are older, and those who frequently attend religious services are less likely to favor conservation. I don't know what the more frequent attendance religious services, but there is some conservatism in this that suggests that those who see themselves as more conservative, and a lot of rural communities are, which I don't think is a bad thing at all, but that somehow relates more to less likely to support conservation. Certainly jobs I can understand, and if there's some perception that conservation means lack of jobs,
sure,
then that's a real problem. But I will tell you, I lived right next to Savannah River Nuclear Plant for a long time, Christy, and they used to be against conservation, but it turns out there are more jobs in the cleanup of that toxic facility than there ever were in the construction of tritium for nuclear weapons.
Wow.
So it's not all about either jobs or conservation. It can be about both. But unfortunately, let's clean it up before there's environmental destruction.
Sure. Well, the next study we have is also about the environment. This is from the Journal of Physical Chemistry, and it's about the chemicals that replaced those ozone-destroying chlorofluorocarbons, or the CFCs, that used to be in aerosol spray cans and air conditioners and those products.
Yeah, and this was really interesting to me. This Journal of Physical Chemistry from the American Chemical Society looked at the replacement products, which were these hydrochlorofluorocarbons, that's a mouthful, but 8 CFCs that replaced the CFCs because they didn't damage the ozone layer. And the whole thing here is that we were protecting the ozone layer, which is a good thing. But what do we know about these HCFCs? Are they toxic themselves?
Well, and the concern is that they may be making a new problem that they're referring to as acid rain, which could also be harmful.
Yeah, and that the computer modeling showed how in the breakdown of these 8 CFCs, they form a different chemical that reacts high in the atmosphere. And this really raises all kinds of questions. We're thinking about the recent oil spill and the chemical dispersants down in Louisiana and Mobile, Alabama, and so forth. They used to break up the oil that we were concerned about one problem, but the chemicals we're using without insufficient science could be causing other problems. And it just makes me a lot more sensitive that we need to have a lot more better knowledge of science before we really run into some of these solutions, because we may have just dramatically increased in this particular case the greenhouse effect of what we're actually trying to protect.
Well, and in this case, they're talking about needing a replacement for the replacement. So I'm grateful for chemists and new technology to forge ahead, but we do need to be careful with what we come up with next.
And speaking about the recent Gulf oil spill, our last research that matters is just a reminder to all of us that the impact of the oil spill is real. There are human consequences, and that they're going to last.
And so there's a lot of discussion and speculation about an increase in stress-related illness and mental health problems from the people who've been affected by the BP spill, and even people just hearing about it on the news and the stress that that causes.
Yeah, we talked about early on in the show, Christy, when we were reviewing data on the Gulf War and other aspects of the Iraq War and Afghanistan, the post-traumatic stress disorder, the mental health disorders, the rise in suicide rates, the bringing people back into the communities. And here we have a natural disaster that's affecting tens of thousands of people in the southeastern United States. And the mental health issues that are going to and are arising now are significant.
That's a good reminder that we need to be reaching out to those people and be sensitive to their needs.
Well, and it's not just about – sure, it's about financial issues and livelihoods and, you know, jobs for years and years and years. But it's also about disruption of ways of living and ways of organizing one's life where one gets one's happiness from.
Sure.
And it's not just about the money. And so I think increased needs in the state of Louisiana actually asked BP Oil for $10 million and didn't get responses initially. And so these are the kinds of things that it affects us here because, you know, it could happen anywhere and we need to be sensitive and doing what we can to support those that are living in these areas.
Agreed. Well, I think, Adam, that's all we'll be able to talk about for Research That Matters. But we've had a chance to talk a little bit about lots of articles about environmental issues, the chemicals used to relieve the ozone problem that created new problems.
Yeah, the needs for the mental health and ongoing needs for that.
Some differences in which communities embrace environmental conservation and which ones don't.
Yep. And when we're sitting down thinking about all these things and we have our low back pain,
should we take glucosamine?
Then we probably aren't going to take glucosamine for that, but probably do some exercises. But that's that'll conclude the Research Matter portions of our show. We'll take a short break, and when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Barbara Reimer about global innovations to improve public health. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, we are really fortunate to have a great guest, Dr. Barbara Reimer, to talk about really the whole field of public health and, more importantly, public health innovations. What is happening in the region, in the United States, around the world in the field of public health in terms of real innovations that are making a difference to people everywhere?
And we would like to welcome Dr. Barbara Reimer. She is Dean and Alumni Distinguished Professor at the Gilling School of Global Public Health at UNC Chapel Hill. She is the author of over 260 publications and has received numerous awards, including the Director's Award from the NIH. She is currently the Vice Chair for the Task Force on Community Preventive Services at the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, and Dr. Reimer was elected to the Institute of Medicine in 2008. So we are thrilled to have such a distinguished person with us today. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You know, Dr. Reimer, we've known each other for a while, and you know, our listeners should really know you have an incredible career, really, in public health and academia. I know you were at Duke University and directing a lot of cancer prevention work and a lot of work in smoking. You went up to the National Cancer Institute and really helped set the course for a lot of the cancer prevention work around the country. And then coming back down here to Carolina and really at the top-rated school of public health, one of the top-rated in the country. And then there was this wonderful article about you that was in the paper not too long ago
yeah.
That was this new insight, which was that you had written a letter to, I guess, after the death of John Kennedy.
Right.
That was picked to be in a book of letters, but it also showed that you cared about public policy and health from a very young age. And one of the things that Christy and I always want to know is, it seems like you've been motivated to be involved in health and policy and making a difference. Why? From a young age, why is that?
Well, I think part of it is I grew up in a family where my parents were passionate about changing the world. My father worked for the American Cancer Society and developed a lot of the smoking, the early smoking ads, the smoking fetus, and some of those that really were anti-smoking.
Wow.
My mother was a social worker. I mean, we really grew up in a family where we felt like we had a mission. And I, reading that letter made me realize that that had been with me a long time, but I hadn't, you know, in some ways it was embarrassing to go back and read the letter, but it also made me realize that I'd been on a path even longer than I realized, you know. Like most people, it took me longer to figure out exactly where that mission was, that it was public health. But I knew I had some purpose in life, and I think that's what the letter showed. But, you know, it was also incredibly naive, and, you know, I'm sure kids
now. Well,
it was now,
idealistic, and
yeah.
I think the fact that you are in a place now as the dean of, again, one of the leading public health schools in the internationally as well as the United States.
Yes.
You have to continue to be inspired and inspire others.
And, you know, I think one of the things that's really gratifying about my job is seeing the young people who come to our school that have that same sense of idealism. You know, they want to change the world, and it's one of the really striking things about our students and our faculty.
We did want to ask about that. With the changes in the School of Public Health, as both Adam and I received our master's in public health at UNC. Yours is as well, right?
Yes, yes. But
the school has changed since that time. We've been, you know, peripherally and some directly a part of it. I know, Adam, you teach some in the School of Public Health. But with the gift and all these new innovations, tell us about how the school's really changed in recent years.
Well, one of the real catalysts for change was the gift that Dennis and Joan Gillings gave us in 2007. And it was an incredibly generous gift. And that gift resulted in a number of things. One is that we changed our name to reflect global. And
sure.
We, you know, talking about innovation, we are the first School of Public Health to have taken the word global into our name.
Really?
And it's really caused a lot of thinking among other schools of public health who, I think, on the one hand, feel like, gee, maybe we need to do that too. On the other hand, they don't want to be followers. So we kind of put them in an interesting dilemma, which, you know, I'm not at all sad about. So we changed our name. We also were able to devote part of the gift to creating innovation labs, so laboratories. And we define laboratory in a very broad sense of the word. It's a group of people solving a problem. And so now we now have 18 of these innovation labs working on everything from Ralph Barrett creating a new type of vaccine that would be able to be done faster and wouldn't require a lot of the startup time of other vaccine development, to Alice Ammerman working on local foods with Duke and the State Health Department and lots of other people, to Will Vizuete, an assistant professor who's developing kind of a miniaturized air pollution device that's able to look at the effects of different concentrations of chemicals in the air on human lung tissue that we're doing with the School of Medicine. So it's created kind of a hotbed for innovation in our school. We also have Gillings visiting professors, people who come in and work with us in the school, and to some extent are there to challenge our ways of thinking so that we grow and we develop as well.
It's interesting because I know when I came to the School of Public Health, actually I came to Chapel Hill after my medical training was to get advanced training in epidemiology. There was this feeling that UNC Chapel Hill was, at that time, still one of the best schools in the country, but it was not known for necessarily global work. If you wanted to do global work, one would go to Johns Hopkins maybe even Harvard. And certainly the word innovation wasn't even invented yet. And if it was, it was applied to business schools. So I'm really kind of curious, this marriage of this word innovation, and you just recently had a whole journal devoted to innovation in the School of Public Health. How did that process really take root and take hold? And it's one thing to say one wants to be international. It's one thing to really spring and leap into it.
Well, you know, I think our school didn't get enough attention over the years for the global work that we were doing. You know, back in the 1950s and 60s, faculty were going to Egypt and Iran and countries all over the world. Dan Okun went to 89 different countries in his 90 years.
Wow.
So our faculty were actually doing an incredible amount of global work, but somehow the school never really got the recognition it deserved in that area, which is one of the reasons I wanted to take the word global. But innovation really has been part of the school's DNA ever since the school started. But I don't think anybody stepped back and looked at the school and looked at what was happening and said, wow, there's a lot of innovation there. I came in kind of as an outsider. I had had an adjunct appointment for many years in the school. But I looked and I saw these incredible people, like the smog chamber that's on the top of our building, which was developed about 20 years ago, is the only smog chamber in the world that can look at the effect of different concentrations of chemicals on human lung tissue.
That wow.
was an incredible innovation that has all sorts of practical applications.
So when you came into this position, you were able to step back and say, wow, we're doing all of these things that are not only new, either a new way of applying technology or a new way of putting that into real-world scenarios.
That's
and I understand
right.
a lot of the faculty are doing real field work all across the world.
Well, one of the things that differentiates our school from other schools of public health is this incredible passion that people have for solving problems. And I think you two can appreciate that because you very much work in the real world. People don't want to just develop esoteric knowledge. They mm-hmm. want to develop knowledge that is applied and makes a difference. And so what I wanted to do in getting this gift and in developing innovation laboratories was making it on an even greater scale. But one of the reasons for this is because there are so many big challenges in public health. We need innovations to solve problems. You know, when you think about a world in which over 1 billion people still don't have safe water to drink, where obesity rates are becoming epidemic. You know, you look at the oil spill in Louisiana, you look at hurricanes. All of these things, all of these threats are public health, and we have to solve problems faster.
It comes back to that sense of responsibility that you had of a child.
Well, I know we need to take a short break, Dr. Reimer. I know when we come back, we really want to get into some really concrete examples of things that are happening there, ranging from hog waste to environmental issues internationally to chronic disease management, things that are really affecting globally hundreds of millions, if not billions, of people around the world. So we're going to take a short break. When we return, we'll continue talking with Dr. Barbara Reimer. We'll be right back with UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Pate. We've been talking with Dr. Barbara Reimer, Dean of the UNC Gilling School of Global Public Health, about innovations in public health and the great work that our School of Public Health is doing to forward the health of our nation and of our globe. And one of the things you mentioned, Dr. Reimer, was the obesity epidemic. And I know that that key faculty and students have been involved in the crusade against obesity, both locally and nationally, and I'm sure internationally as well. I wonder if you would share a little bit about innovations in the world of obesity.
Well, our school has been one of the leaders nationally and internationally. And just to say, it's a really critical issue in North Carolina because we're 41st of all states in obesity, so we're near the bottom. Some of the most exciting work in the school has been done by Barry Popkin. Barry is an amazing man who has been tracking populations for many years, and he's credited with an incredible innovation of really describing and explaining what's now called the nutrition transition. So Barry has been studying people as they've aged and populations as they age all around the world. And what he's shown is that we've changed how we've eaten, we've changed when we eat, how often we eat, the situations in which we eat, and what we drink, particularly sugary sodas and soft drinks. And he's contributed the understanding that it's really the change in drinks, in sugary drinks, that have accounted for a lot of the change in weight. And when you look at the fact that people get about 460-some calories a day from sugar drinks, it should be around 100 calories or 104. And that accounts for a lot of the change in our weight as a society. So Barry's made an important contribution in terms of knowledge. He's also applied that knowledge. He's working with governments in Mexico and in several other countries to use taxes to change what people drink.
I understand that makes him not very popular in the food industry and in from soft drink makers.
I'm sure there are places in the world Barry would not want to go, but it's a really fundamental kind of knowledge that could be applied in this state. We know that about 1 cent per ounce could make a difference, could reduce consumption by about 23%. And, of course, Adam knows from his work in tobacco that there's very good evidence that taxation changes consumption, particularly in the young. So this is really important. But there are lots of other things coming out of our school as well. Deborah Tate is an associate professor in health behavior and also nutrition. She was one of the first people to realize that online you could develop dietary counseling programs to people who don't necessarily want to go to groups or go to in-person programs. And she found that they were just as effective as in-person kinds of programs. So think of the impact of that globally when you can actually deliver programs over the internet. Diane Ward is a professor in nutrition. And Diane looked at the obesity problem in North Carolina, and she realized that if we don't start young, we're not going to be able to change this epidemic. And she started working with preschools and teaching them how to set up the preschool, how to choose foods, how to get kids more active. And her program was recently recommended by the First Lady, Michelle Obama, as
wow.
part of her effort to prevent childhood obesity. So, you know, I think that's really impressive. Yeah.
This vision, really, of public health, and you really are describing a vision. It's what you're doing, but it's also kind of a vision of what you should be doing. I don't think that that's always been a vision of how others have necessarily viewed public health, maybe at this university, maybe at others, but that perhaps historically, from the great pioneers of public health, they always did see this connection between the research and the practice, the applicability.
Right.
So I wonder if what, you know, it seems like we've returned to this real importance, and you've described research all the way from the bench to the political and the ability of people involved to have that type of vision. Has there had to been a culture change here or among your colleagues nationally?
I think there's been a huge culture change. A number of people looked at public health practice and they said, gee, we've learned a lot in laboratories, in clinics, but we haven't applied it. We haven't applied it in medicine, and that's been a huge culture shift there. And so a number of key gatekeepers of influentials started paying more attention to this question of translation, of dissemination. And our school has been doing it better than almost any place else. And it goes back to the early days of the school. We can discover great insights, but if we don't apply them, it doesn't improve the public's health.
Well,
it doesn't make people better.
I've also been impressed with, at least from my perspective, it seems that the students that you're teaching are involved from the get-go. These students are going all over the world and involved in that practical application from the beginning of their training in many cases, and that will transition into more of that sort of transitional or translational research as you go forward, which is really amazing.
That's a great observation. And I've seen Mark Sobsey, for example, works in the area of water. And his students have worked with him in developing a new ceramic water filter that's better than others. But they didn't just come up with the water filter. They then showed that it actually reduced diarrheal diseases. Then they started working with Kenan Flagler Business School to come up with a way to scale up production. And they recently got an $8 million grant from USAID to test it in Cambodia and several other countries. So we do go from that laboratory, somebody like Mark Sobsey, out into communities around the world.
And then to collaborate with the business school just makes so much sense to use that expertise to then help make it more real and applicable.
It really does.
Yeah, I know that some of your work doesn't come without controversy. You're
That's
pushing
true.
New ground, and I recall not a lot, but there were those who questioned when you received this large gift from an entrepreneur, mm-hmm. and you're describing some entrepreneurial type things. Talk for just a second, because we don't have too much time left, but talk about what are the real challenges that the school is facing, that you face in your work, and that the public health is facing? Because I think we're hitting around the edges, but mm-hmm. I'd like to know, what do you see as the challenges?
Well, I think in terms of the school, some of the challenges are the state budget and the fact that, you know, we can't give raises to faculty and they're getting recruited by other universities. Mm-hmm. We don't have enough scholarships for our students. But those are the kind of experiences that we have now because it's a terrible budget and hopefully it'll get better. But public health has, as a field, has huge challenges that we now see this obesity epidemic that is going to change the world in terms of diet. We'll have billions of cases of diabetes in 2020. The fact that Haiti, you know, is devastated by a hurricane and that we're, you know, there have been accounts in the last few days that still it's not much better. We have a huge task in public health, and it's hugely underfunded. And so, you know, we were the first state that developed accreditation of local public health departments. It's not in the budget. It's not in the state's budget to cover it. So other states are now overtaking us. And that's really unfortunate because we were a leader in recognizing that public health should be accredited.
And we haven't even talked about global warming, the environment, a lot of the issues, oil.
Right.
I mean, you're talking about having to do 10 times more with less.
Sure. That's right.
Less.
And almost every issue touches on public health. Mm-hmm. You know, I say that all things come back to our school because there's hardly any issue that you face that doesn't have a public health implication.
That is
well,
a great
we're,
point.
We're going to need to wrap up, but we've been talking with Dr. Barbara Reimer. We want to thank you so much, Dean of the UNC Gilling School of Global Public Health, for coming on our show, talking with us, sharing some of the excitement, some of the great achievements, but also now in the challenges. And perhaps we can invite you back on our show in another year, and because I'm sure the landscape will change and the successes will change and the challenges will also change.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I've really enjoyed it.
Thank you, Dr. Reimer.
Thanks.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Golsey and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about your questions, your health experiences, and your attitudes towards medical care.
In lots of ways, you can send us your own thoughts. You can email them to us at yourhealth@unc.edu. Or you can call us at 919-966-8081. And we'd like to ask our executive producer, Julie Steiner, to read us our House Call first question today.
Our first listener says, I have gone with my 76-year-old father to the doctor many times and listened as the doctor asked my father if he was taking his medications as directed. Every time, my dad said yes, and the physician then went on and made new recommendations. The last time we were in, his family physician asked us if we would take our father to their clinic to meet with their pharmacist to review his medications, as he felt like some confusion might exist. Well, was he ever right? My dad was taking old medications, was taking his blood pressure pill once instead of twice a day, and was not taking his arthritis pills that he was supposed to be taking. The pharmacist spent time with us and gave us a pill box. This was so simple, but so amazing. If this is part of the new primary care medical home you have been talking about, I'm all for it.
That is great news.
Yahoo!
Yeah,
your primary care practice there, and it's a practice, it's not just a doctor, is on board, and that's a great story.
It is. It really speaks to the benefit of team-based care, where doctors work with pharmacists and social workers and nurses and really work together as a team to take care of our patients. And in this case, the pharmacist played a really important role.
Yeah, you know, in the old model, I would have had some suspicion that things weren't right. and I would have probably asked your father to bring his pillbox in to see me or bring the medicines back in. But we would have gone round and round for quite a bit, and I've had maybe about 5 minutes to have gotten this done. And in this particular setting, you had a different provider, or a different clinician, a pharmacist that could spend as much time as needed to really sit down and find out what's going on to confirm the suspicions that things weren't the way they seemed.
Mm-hmm. And pillboxes are so helpful, so I'm glad that's been a good thing for
your
father.
And it's not just about taking the medications he was supposed to be taking. It was also getting rid of the medications that he wasn't supposed to be taking.
Yep.
It shows how frequently things can go amiss. And I know, Christy, I've had lots of patients. I say, are you taking this medicine? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. How are you taking it? Exactly as you told me to. Are you taking it twice today? Mm-hmm. And then you find out sometime down the road they've been taking it once a day.
Mm-hmm.
So lots of problems. Great answers.
Thanks for sharing with us. Julie, what do we have next?
I am a 29-year-old woman who gets urinary tract infections twice a year. I've been worked up in the past and no abnormality was found. When I take antibiotics early, it goes away. Going to the doctor is expensive and time-consuming, so I asked my doctor to give me a prescription for antibiotics that I can take when I get symptoms. She refused, and so I found another doctor who agreed to do this. He said that if it didn't respond, I could then come in for a test. This seems more reasonable to me. What do you think?
Well, we think that's definitely more reasonable, and in some respects it could be.
Yeah, I think it speaks to the relationship with your doctor. There are three different studies that have documented that self-treatment can be an appropriate approach. So women can self-diagnose 85 to 95% of the time. And so the recommendations are that this approach is reserved for women who have a clear history documenting the frequent infections and who have a close relationship with their doctor. And so it sounds like, at least with the one doctor you have now, you've been able to show that documentation, develop that relationship, and that can be an acceptable approach for some doctors and patients to work out.
Yeah, the one thing I'll add is that sometimes I will give antibiotics, but, you know, I will also want to see the patient once a year. So I sometimes will have patients, you know, you're young, pretty healthy, may not need your pap smear every 3 years. And, you know, you'll go 2 years out and you'll still want antibiotics to be called in. And I would like to maybe get a urine test on you once a year. Now, I want to review things, and so I don't think it's unreasonable to ask you to come in and be seen once a year to maybe get those antibiotic prescriptions.
I agree with that as well, because there can be harm from just prescribing antibiotics without actually knowing the patient and having those details.
There you go.
Okay, Julie, what's next?
I believe my mother may have early Alzheimer's. What tests can you do to diagnose it early, and does it matter?
Well, clearly it matters to you, and it matters to lots of our patients and lots of our own family members who increasingly may get Alzheimer's. We do want to know early on, and I hear this all the time, Christy, that patients and their loved ones worry that they might have Alzheimer's.
Yeah, and it's tough because the diagnosis is really based on a full history and physical, which is and some tests potentially to rule out other causes for problems in thinking. But the treatments, which are usually these medications called cholinesterase inhibitors, they can make a small improvement in thinking and ability to perform just those activities of daily living in people who have that mild to moderate dementia, but there isn't a lot of evidence showing that they have a real long-term benefit.
The earlier we start them, potentially, I mean, rather than starting them really late in the process, you're more likely to preserve that function. And the question of diagnosing it early is an interesting one. It used to be that the only way you could diagnose Alzheimer's was really on brain biopsy, which is a little late for most people.
Right.
But I read some interesting things about, while there's not a whole lot of real evidence, tremendous research that this is going to be used, there's some really interesting things that if you ask people, you know, to things, little simple tests, a computation test, and thinking questions that require them to remember four or five things, that most of us can do things like that. And if people can't do these things and there's two or three of these simple tests, that might be a clue way before a lot of the more official tests that people can do.
So I think if you're concerned about it, it's an issue in your family, you should definitely get that evaluation and talk to your doctor about it.
Yeah. So what is our very last house call?
I have a 2-year-old son who has had frequent ear infections. While I do smoke, I never smoke around him. Recently, though, when I went to my family doctor, he said that third-hand smoke, residue on my clothes, could still be causing my son's ear problems, and he referred me to a smoking cessation specialist. He did not seem to judge me, but simply told me the facts and offered to help. Thanks.
That is one good doctor that you saw to give you that information and to deliver it in a way that you didn't feel judged, but really felt like he was trying to help. That's great.
Well, and we've talked about third-hand smoke on the show before.
We have,
and
quite a bit.
You got a great example. And that third-hand smoke can be really irritating and allergenic to your child. So the doctor was right. But what I really liked about this is that he referred you to someone who could do more counseling perhaps than either he was trained to or that he had time for, or maybe because of your addiction felt that you maybe needed some specialized care.
Well, that also speaks to that team-based approach, Adam. We were just talking about the benefit of doctors working with a team, and in this case, it's a smoking cessation specialist who can counsel you and really take that time to follow and help you quit. So
yeah,
good for you for getting help.
And we actually have a nicotine dependence program at the University of North Carolina, and we actually have trained tobacco treatment specialists as part of that. So a type of referral might go to one of these trained tobacco treatment specialists who are trained both in the therapy of smoking cessation addiction, but also to help work with you with the pharmacology, with the physician and the pharmacist in this team approach that Christy's mm-hmm. mentioning, and to stay with you as long as you want without judging, but as long as you want to quit, to stay with you to the place that you are quit for good.
Yep. Well, we've had a chance to talk about some various house calls, from the dangers of smoke on your clothes or third-hand smoke, and
to maybe some very simple tests that you can do about remembering and counting to help diagnose early Alzheimer's and get treated.
A little bit about urinary tract infections and self-treatment.
And the real benefit of the primary care medical home that really can increase compliance with the types of things that your doctor wants you to do and doesn't want you to do as it relates to medications.
That's right. So thank you for your questions, and thank you for joining us today for Your Health. We hope we've addressed some issues and concerns that are important to you, and we want you to share your health-related questions. And we have lots of ways for you to contact us. Here you go. You can email us at yourhealth@unc.edu.
You can call us at 919-966-8081.
You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org.
And you can also follow us on Twitter at twitter.com and search for Your Health Radio.
We'd like to thank the staff of WCHL and the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, our producer Julie Steiner, and our great guest today, Dr. Barbara Reimer. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of UNC Family Medicine, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And we look forward to talking with you again next week.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. You can also go to our website, 1360WCHL.com, and click on WCHL On Demand. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360 WCHL.